Welcome to the Euro Auto Training Garage Spiel Podcast. Garage Spiel Podcasts are brought to you by your friends at Baum Tools Unlimited and Stahlwilly Tools North America. Learn more at www.baumtools.com and www.stahlwilly.com. Baum Tools Unlimited and Stahlwilly Tools North America are proud to underwrite the Garage Spiel Podcast. This is part 6 of our 8-part interview with Dennis Simonitis, Road & Track Magazine's engineering editor. In this episode, Dennis tells us which alternative power technology just might be the most promising, and talks a little about the issues surrounding ethanol.
Of all the alternatives that are being explored today, what do you think is the most promising, and how come?
I think all of the above. In fact, maybe that's an important point. There's been a really good book fairly recently by Larry Burns, who used to be the he's retired now, but he used to be the GM fuel cell guy and in charge of research for GM, and he was a proponent of GM's fuel cell research, Larry Burns, and another guy named Chris Barone Bird, who's still at GM, and a third guy named Bill Mitchell, who's at MIT. They've written a book on the automobile, personal mobility, in the 21st century, our century. Doesn't seem odd to call it the 21st century. In any case, in our century, in the urban setting, what are we going to have? What should we have? And one of the points they make is diversity. That's what we should have. Unlike 110 years ago, when the gasoline won out over diesel and over steam, not over diesel, over electricity and over steam. Diesel didn't come along until the 30s. Gasoline went out over steam and over electricity 110 years ago. That's not going to happen now. There should be, and there will be, diversity in propulsion, mainly because of efficiency and because we want what we want the vehicle to do. And just to think of this is all from their book, but it's also very sensible. And other people say it as well. For short trip, and it's kind of obvious when you think about it, for short trip, low speed, urban, an electric car. Why not? An electric car beats the other one silly. You're only going a short distance. You're not going very fast. Pure electric, a BEV, as it's called, battery electric vehicle. At the other extreme, high load for trucks or buses, high speed for cars. Eventually, you want a fuel cell car. It's the most efficient. It has enough power, and it has range, which the electric car, the battery, the BEV, is never going to have. In fact, remember, the fuel cell car is also an electric car, but it's an electric car that makes its own electricity on board via the fuel cell.
Right.
So we should call it maybe an FCEV. I don't know how you pronounce that. But so the fuel cell car, fuel cell electric, is what you want for long distance, high load trucks and stuff, and passenger cars. Electric pure BEV is what you want in the city. Kind of in the middle for mixed use or for you only want one car, okay, that's when you want some kind of hybrid. You want either a Prius-type hybrid that's a gasoline electric. Maybe you want a plug-in electric like the Volt or like the Prius plug-in's going to be, where you get sort of a compromise of each of those extremes with some advantages of each. But notice, I suppose I could call at least 4 different kinds of propulsion if I separate the 2 kinds of hybrids. And then when you start talking about hybrids in a deep dive, you really have a multiplicity of hybrids, too. In any case, it's not just one that's winning out. So which one do I like? Gee, I like them all. In the long term, for a lot of cars, the fuel cell is going to win out. Mainly because it's going to... Now, it ain't going to win out in 2 years when we see the first fuel cell cars hitting the market, which is in itself amazing and newsworthy. Finally, after all these years, there are going to be fuel cell cars for sale. Toyota's announced it. Mercedes has announced it. Hyundai is likely to have one as well. Honda already has them out, admittedly in very small numbers.
Sure.
And only for lease. But... So fuel cell cars are finally coming. For a long time, they used to say, the best technology that's always 15 years away. Nope, 15 years has come. It's going to happen. It's It's going to
happen. Are fuel cell cars being used in fleets in cities now?
Only in research, academically, sort of.
Like, nothing in from a business standpoint. Honda
Clarity.
Yeah.
There are, I'm not sure if they've said how many exactly, but, you know, less than 100.
Okay.
In lease to private individuals.
Okay. Yeah.
Toyota fuel cell cars. There are several nearby here at University of California, Irvine, where the National Fuel Cell Research Center is located.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, and I think there are some sort of supplier friends in-house who have them in, let's call them private hands, but special private hands. Here in California, we have a California Fuel Cell Partnership based in Sacramento that has all the manufacturers. I mean, Toyota, Honda, Mercedes, Volkswagen, Hyundai, GM. I'm sure I'm leaving some others out. I don't mean to. Any case, anyone who's doing fuel cell research has a fuel cell car up in Sacramento as part of this partnership. And they're dealing with all the problems of durability and cost and infrastructure.
Infrastructure being a huge issue.
That's a huge one. Yep. But even that's... here's a good little factoid that I've dined out on. I can get hydrogen 24/7 about 6 miles from my home or from this office. If I wanted to use E85 flex fuel, I have to drive about, I don't know, 40 or 50 miles. I think the nearest one I know of is maybe 50 miles away.
The
85% ethanol,
sure.
15 gasoline.
The ethanol,
which by the way is quite common in parts of the Midwest.
Parts of the Midwest, but it's not a
not
very
out
efficient,
here yet.
Not a very efficient.
That's
fuel here, is it?
Yes, that's true. In fact, I would say, not to go off on a tangent and get on a little box again, but corn ethanol is a mistake, and people are now generally agreeing it is. Corn ethanol was foisted upon us for a bunch of reasons, some of which were good, were valid. You know, it's renewable and we grow our own and all that stuff. But I don't know that, again, this is from just what the smart people have told me. I don't know that the right political people talk to the right smart people, or at least believe them, when this whole issue came up.
You might open a can of worms saying the right political people.
Well, I mean...
There might not be any right political people.
Yeah, the people who had the responsibility of setting the standards.
Got it.
You know, we have a very aggressive alternative fuel mandate.
Right.
Which one hopes would work with certain kinds of ethanol.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a second if you like. But it doesn't work with corn ethanol. It just... flat doesn't work.
I've read South America produces ethanol in a very efficient way from...
Yep, Brazil.
From, I'm not going to say sugar cane.
You're right. No,
is
it? Sugar cane, yeah.
It
does, but and indeed it works in Brazil.
In Brazil, very specific use.
Yes, and there are about 5 reasons why it does, and I'll say why it would be a harder thing here. One is climate.
Yeah.
One is labor practices.
Yeah,
In their farming versus up here. Those are 2 major ones. And climate in general. I mean, sugarcane is a hot climate crop. There are only a few places in the U.S. where you can grow sugarcane. And if you could grow it, could you grow it on the... In the scale that we would need it using the farm practices that we hold dear as human beings? Nope, the Brazilians are... I mean, this is a controversial or a non-controversial thing. This is something that's generally accepted, that the farm practices in Brazil are quite different from the practices here. So sugarcane, yeah, works there very well. The most important thing, even forgetting the sociological aspects of the farmers and such, or the farm labor, the climate is a real killer. Brazil has E100, i.e. straight ethanol,
right,
available at the pump. They also have gasoline, which is really heavily ethanolized. It's like E24 or something like that. It's a real high percentage of ethanol. Well, 2 things. One is, of course, if you have a car that's going to run straight ethanol, like our flex fuel fuel cars, you have to do different things to the fuel delivery system.
Right.
You have to, because ethanol is real corrosive. So you have to put in special fuel delivery and then special hoses and special tubes and special fuel delivery. Special, I was about to say carburation, shows you my age, special fuel injection. So in any case, also, the cars in Brazil are equipped with, the 100, E100 cars, are equipped with little gasoline canisters under the hood that are used for cold start. And by cold start, they mean under anything under about 60 degrees Fahrenheit, 60. So, you know, think of all the parts in the U.S. where a pure ethanol car just flat would not work.
Right.
In fact, that's why we have E85. We have E85. The 15, at least the main reason the 15% is there, is for cold start and for general drivability. Because in our climate, ethanol is not a, pure ethanol is not a viable fuel. So even if we had cheap ethanol, we probably wouldn't want to use it at more than 85. And then there are other problems with ethanol. There, the corn, the biggest problem with corn, of course, is food versus fuel.
Right.
It's stuff that you can eat, too.
Right.
And so why should you grow this stuff when much of the world is starving? It doesn't equate. It doesn't work out.
Sure.
There are other problems that are not just corn-related, but to some extent, biofuel. Bio in the sense of corn or sugarcane or this third. The third, by the way, is cellulosic. You've probably heard that term.
Yep.
Cellulosic ethanol is ethanol that uses not the kernel, not the stuff you might eat, but everything else.
Yep.
So it uses switchgrass, it uses stalks, it uses what we think of as weeds. Yes, that stuff can be used, or rather is in development and in research and development levels right now to produce ethanol. And there's a lot of money involved, there's a lot of research involved, a lot of politics involved too, about who is where and how far away and how near are they to having it ready to pump tomorrow.
Sure.
From the people I talk with, the answer is it isn't that far. It's still, it's promising, and people get breakthroughs, and people worry about it. But right now, our ethanol is corn ethanol. And right now, that's a bad idea for a whole bunch of reasons. As I said, the one being food versus fuel. Another being, if you look at it from completely overall, you draw way back, and you do what's called well-to-wheel analysis, or in this case, I guess it's field to wheel analysis.
Yep.
You look at the everything. You look at the amount of fuel that's used to get the product from the field to the refinery.
Yep.
And the amount of fuel used to get it from the refinery to the distribution, from the distribution to the gas pump. Not gas pump anymore. Ethanol pump. If you look at all those things, it turns out, if you look at the land use, the land that's taken out of producing food or taken out of building a new shopping mall, if you look at land use and all those other things, it's not even true that that corn ethanol is environmentally a very good idea. It's, you can get arguments either side. But there's enough evidence by people, you know, who study this stuff and who are smart to suggest that corn ethanol just is not the way to go.
Just not
cellulosic
the idea.
Would make some sense if you can do it. But it still has some shortcomings. One shortcoming is, in general, if you're growing stuff and then taking it to someplace to turn it into fuel.
Right, sure.
And then your product is ethanol and you want to take it someplace to use it in a car. There are some disadvantages. One is the stuff is real dispersed. It's all over the place. It's not like poke a hole in the ground, you get this really thick, dense stuff called petroleum.
Right.
It's all over. You have to get weeds from here and there and here and there. You have to truck it, collect those things, and then truck them to the facility. Once you get it, which is a disadvantage, because notice how you're going to truck it there. You're trucking it there with a diesel truck.
Diesel truck, sure.
Okay. Or maybe an ethanol truck, I don't know. In any case, once you get it there and you end up with ethanol, how do you want to get it to the how to say, how do you get it to the distributor and then ultimately to the user?
Right.
The disadvantage is you cannot put it in conventional gasoline pipelines because ethanol is hygroscopic. It absorbs water like crazy. Witness how well a gin and tonic fixes itself or a scotch and water fixes itself.
Sure. Yeah.
It mixes. Okay, so does ethanol that we want to put in a car tank. And for that reason, they cannot pump ethanol through the lines that are already all over the country for gasoline. They have to send it by truck or by rail car. And there again, it's not nearly as efficient as piping that stuff through a pipeline.
Right.
And I guess you could build dedicated pipelines, but I don't know. The mind boggles at that cost.
The infrastructure is an enormous barrier in that case.
So,
sure.
And then, once you get it in the vehicle, it's still, because of its energy content, you get a 20-25% hit on fuel economy.
Right.
Which means if you have a flex fuel vehicle and you have a choice, you're going to fill up now with gasoline and get 20 mile per gallon, or you're going to fill up with ethanol and get 16 mile per gallon.
Right.
By the way, if those numbers sound phony, look at the EPA guide and where it shows for flex fuel cars the official EPA measurements for the two fuels. And that's kind of the difference. You know, it's a more than just a minor difference. Which fuel are you going to use? You're going to use gasoline. It's easy. It's easier to find. Maybe the ethanol might be a little bit cheaper, but once you figure out this 20% hit in fuel economy, it may not even be cheaper anymore.
Well, then the CAFE standards would, logically, then the CAFE standards being, raised in terms of corporate...
They fool around, though. See, the CAFE standards are basically, they measure gasoline use. They don't...
Really?
Yeah. But there's enough here to cross my eyes. You get credit for a flex fuel car, even if you don't have to prove that it's being used as a flex fueler. You get credit for producing it, but only up to a certain amount of MPG difference. It's in the, you have to dig into the regulation of the federal reg. I seem to recall it's like a 1-point-something MPG benefit. But you do not get, one, you don't get penalized for using the flex fuel. Two, you don't get unlimited benefit for it being a renewable fuel and being not gasoline.
Huh.
So it's worked in the law where you get a little bit of benefit, but not a lot. But in particular, the deficit of the fuel does not hurt you in CAFE.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So CAFE in itself won't kill ethanol as an alternative?
No, it won't. The pros and cons of how you measure CAFE can certainly complicate it.
Right.
You know, if they chose to encourage E85 by saying, we'll give you up to a 5 MPG or a 15 MPG benefit or some magic number. Because you could say, for example, that an E100 car using straight ethanol, it's getting infinite mile per gallon.
Right.
I mean, it's not using any gasoline, and gasoline is
what
we're trying to preserve and what we're protecting and all that jazz. So at least from one point of view, you could argue that an ethanol car should get a lot of benefit in something like CAFE. But then the other side is, but how do you know that these people who have flex fuel cars are actually going to the E85 station and not just using gasoline, especially when it seems easier and sort of how often do they have to go, from one point of view. So they have purposely put this cap on how much benefit one can get for a flex fuel car and worked it into the regulation. And by fooling with that cap, they could encourage it or discourage it. Right now, they seem to have held steady on it. By the way, that raises another interesting question that we haven't talked about. We haven't talked about E10, which is what we have in most gas stations around the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 10% ethanol extended.
Right.
And what's happening with that? Want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is another sticky can of worms, but I've already talked about it, so the angry letters come. E85 has been less than successful. Why? Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons. One, it's relatively concentrated in the upper Midwest. Two, everything we've talked about. So, all these people who got into the business with dollar signs in their eyes,
yep,
are finding themselves with a glut, would you believe, a glut of ethanol. And they're saying, what are we going to do with this glut of ethanol? We've invested all this money in this refinery. We can't sell this stuff. Well, they went to the government and lobbied. And they said, you know, we have E10 now for regular gasoline as an extender. What if we raise that to E15? What if we sell 50% more ethanol to you guys? And, you know, the government kind of scratched its head and said, well, God, I don't know. We have to figure out whether this is going to work. I mean, will cars still run on E15? And so they talked to the automakers, and the automakers said, we don't know. You know, you asked us to make sure it would run on E10. And so some researchers have looked at it. A lot of researchers have looked at it. And they've generally come to the conclusion, though not without controversy, they've generally come to the conclusion that newer cars that are designed for E10 can take E15 without any problem. What's newer? They said originally 2007 and newer. You know, EPA said, okay, we're going to allow E15 in the gas stations of the world, of the country, but only for cars 2007 and newer. And again, other people scratched their head and said, what about my 2003 car? What am I going to do? Are they going to have separate tanks? Are they going to have some sort of dial that people are going to screw up, of course? How are we going to handle this? And when the car breaks, who's responsible? Is the government going to cover my warranty? Or is the auto company going to be responsible? And those questions are still unresolved. However, they, in its infinite wisdom, the EPA said, we'll go back to 2001, I think it is. So you know, my our Miata, being a 1990 car, is it going to be okay on E15? Mazda's not going to say yes.
No, of course not, right?
Because they don't know. They honestly don't know. Also, what about my lawnmower? What about my weed whacker? What about all my little gasoline engines that are designed for gasoline and whose makers never thought about ethanol of any kind?
Right.
They're in for unknowns. So you've got a whole bunch of people, the automakers, the small engine manufacturers, marine manufacturers.
Sure,
because,
sure,
again, they're
huge industry.
Engines aren't designed.
Right.
They don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't designed for ethanol. It turns out the grocers of America, because they don't like the effect of ethanol on food prices.
Of course.
Because they have to pass the prices on, and then their customers get angry. So there's just all kinds of curiously disparate groups. You know, here's the small engine manufacturers of the world sitting down with the grocers of America with something in common. And so that's all those people are saying, I think E15 is a pretty stupid idea. And here's the guys who got stuck with this glut of ethanol because they saw dollar signs.
Yeah.
But they got to the right people first. And here we are with E15, my friend.
Yeah.
Yet to be decided how it's going to be handled. It's going to have to be handled, I would guess, with some sort of adjustable gizmo.
It's going to be
on the pump.
It seems to me it's going to be nearly impossible.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's going to be complicated. Remember a long time ago, Sunoco.
Yeah.
When you bought the two or three grades, you could buy, as I recall, more than two or three grades. Sunoco had this dial.
Sure, I remember that.
Yep, and you could adjust it for high test, really high test, or maybe two or three grades in between.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing, and I suspect maybe I've even read someplace that this is the plan, there'll be a similar gizmo on your pump, and you'll set it to maybe a E15, or E10. That'll be the easiest. It'll be binary, either one or the other. if you wanted to be, I suppose you could have three and have an E85, E15, and E10 and one E thing, because you're somehow or other. But I'm sure that wouldn't work because the downside of misfueling is much too high.
Well, and misfueling would be
rampant.
It would.
just
recently, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration has been wrestling with whether or not to create a recall situation for Volkswagen in the United States. Uh-huh. Their diesel engines, quite a few of the diesel engines, have failed dramatically.
These are the non-urea, of course. They're the ones with the individual.
These are relatively new. Models that are out.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I don't think they use urea.
They do not use urea
in the Jetta engines, for instance.
Yes, they do not.
Passats, yeah. Right?
In the
maybe in the Touareg.
In the bigger ones, yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
But in this study, Volkswagen has come back and said the problem isn't our technology. The problem is that the American drivers are putting gasoline in the diesel tanks.
Oh, jeez.
And
okay.
And while I like to diss Volkswagen whenever I can, I think they got a point. Because if you've used diesel cars,
sure.
And you can not put a diesel filler into a gasoline engine.
That's right. Yeah,
but you
could
put,
do the opposite.
You could probably put two. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to E15 and distinguishing that from E10... at the pump, I don't have a lot of faith.
No.
Be sure to check out the rest of our interview with Dennis at www.euroautotraining.com.